We're going to discuss today questions of bad advice. Good advice is actually a mitzvah, but as in a lot of halacha, a lot of Jewish law, the more interesting questions have to do with bad advice, the things that you, prohibitions you can violate by offering bad advice. Subtitle is the fiduciary and suitability standards for investment advisors. A little bit of background, discuss what we're going to be dealing with. Some of you probably know this a lot better than I do. But investment advisors are commonly held to one of two standards. There is the lower, easier suitability standard and the higher, stricter, much more rigorous fiduciary standard. Suitability standard requires that the product that a broker-dealer or some certain types of investment advisors sell you be merely suitable for the client, as long as it's something that is reasonably consistent with his needs, his investment objectives. You can sell it to him. There might be a better one available. You might be getting a fatter commission off this one that you're selling as opposed to the other one. A disinterested advisor or one who was purely loyal to the customer might recommend something else. Doesn't matter. As long as this one is, generally speaking, suitable for the client, you are okay under the suitability standard. Fiduciary standard is a much higher, much more rigorous standard. There are a variety of definitions, and some of these rulemaking stuff they put out, there are hundreds and thousands of pages trying to define exactly what it means and what all the rules are. But basically, in a nutshell, it requires a duty of loyalty to the client. You have to put his interests ahead of yours. You have to advise him in ways that are in his best interest, even if they are not in your best interest. You certainly can't be taking commissions from investments that you're recommending if they're not in the best interest of the client. And in general, they tend to be more fee-based or more salary-based, percentage of assets, rather than getting commissions off individual investments, because that inherently sets up a conflict of interest. You're not supposed to have conflict of interest. You have to disclose them. The fiduciary standard is a much higher standard. Now, historically, for the last several decades, there was no general requirement that any type of broker or anybody has to meet the fiduciary standard. If you specify in your contract that you're meeting the fiduciary standard, then you have to. But if you don't claim that, then you don't. There are certain types of investment advisors that are required to, what they call financial advisors as opposed to brokers, who have been operating under the fiduciary standard. But there are a lot of, certainly what the layman would call investment professionals, brokers and dealers of various sorts, are not operating under the fiduciary standard. They may very well be making recommendations where the client could do better. The client can do a lot better if he were doing something else, and that is perfectly legal under the current rules. People don't like this. It kind of boggles the mind that this situation is tolerated. Recently, there have been various moves to move more people over, more types of professionals over to the fiduciary standard. In particular, the Department of Labor had a rule which, after a lot of starting and stopping and spluttering and delays, and some portion of it kicked into effect in the beginning of June, that says, as part of the retirement framework, ERISA, the ERISA, says that anyone dealing with retirement investments is going to have to operate under the fiduciary standard. Now, there are still whole exceptions and exceptions to the exceptions and phase-ins, and people are still trying to figure out by 2029 what portions of the law will be in effect or not. This is the bureaucracy we're dealing with, but basically there have been major moves recently. President Obama, you can refer to the article I wrote recently, whenever this article was published, had been talking about moving everyone over to the fiduciary standard. Hasn't happened yet. You know, won't happen for a while, certainly. But it's really a remarkable state of affairs that goes on, that currently all kinds of financial professionals can say, you know, I want to sell you this stock, I want to sell you this product. It does not actually have to be in your best interest. Recently, I was floored by this. Recently, I saw one of the personal finance bloggers was talking about S&P index funds. If you buy a good one, let's say Vanguard, BlackRock, you can pay 0.04% on a good S&P 500 index. You can buy other S&P 500 index funds where you're paying about 1% in management fees. You'd have to be crazy because legally, under their prospectus, they're required to do exactly the same thing, which is track the S&P as closely as they can. So who in his right mind is paying 20 times as much, more than 20 times as much, 25 times as much, to go from 0.04% to 1%? Very likely someone's taking commissions on these things and selling them. So I don't even know if that would even fit. I mean, they have billions of dollars there. So somebody must feel it certainly isn't, whoever's selling them these products is certainly not meeting any kind of fiduciary standard. Maybe they're meeting some kind of suitability standard, and hard to know, but it's kind of crazy what's going on out there. So the question is, what we're going to discuss today is from the halakhic perspective, what sorts of rules, what sorts of laws in the Torah govern the provision of advice, what type of advice, both as an advisor, as a salesman. Obviously, intuitively, we feel that a seller, a vendor, is governed by a different set of rules than an advisor. If I'm a seller and I come to you and say, buy my product, you know, buy my services, this is what I'm offering, I think it's great, I think you should buy it, I think intuitively we feel he should be held to a lower standard than if I'm an advisor who, I'm not selling you my own stuff, I'm simply issuing you recommendations. We somehow feel that his advice intuitively needs to be more honest, so to speak. And the sellers, we know that they're promoting their product and they're spinning things their way, and I have to do my due diligence, caveat emptor, and make my decision, as long as he's not misleading or denying. But certainly in the case of an advisor, what are the halakhic rules that govern the type of advice you need to provide? So from a Torah perspective, the main rule here, the main prohibition that we're dealing with is lifnei iver l'sitein michshol, the prohibition against placing a stumbling block in the path of the blind. A couple of verses in the Bible about it, lifnei iver l'sitein michshol, simple prohibition. It's repeated again as a curse, as an imprecation, orur mashke iver badarach. Cursed is he who leads astray the blind man on the road, and the curse is at Har Grizim and Har Ebal, Mount Grizim and Mount Ebal. So what exactly does it mean not to put a stumbling block in the path of the blind? So in rabbinic literature, there are three interpretations of this verse that appear in various comments on the matter. There is the literal interpretation: do not place a physical stumbling block in the path of a man who is physically blind. There is a prohibition against giving bad advice. And then there is a prohibition against causing someone to sin, causing someone to transgress. Now, by far, the vast majority of halakhic literature on this topic is about version number three, the prohibition against causing somebody to sin, with regards to things like Sabbath violations, with regard to things like non-kosher food, selling somebody non-kosher food, offering somebody non-kosher food, inviting somebody to your home on Shabbos, where you know they're going to be driving. All these things are discussed, and the vast majority of the halakhic literature concerns number three, causing somebody to sin.
It would seem like one of those is different than the other two. For example, you say to somebody you know lives beyond driving distance, would you like to come over for Shabbat lunch? That person has all the facts in front of him. Whereas if someone comes over to your house and they just assume that you're serving them kosher food, this would be. Is there any distinction?
That's an important question. That's going to cut to the heart of our question. Oh. The language of the Bible is iver, someone who is blind. So in one case it means literally blind. In one case it means someone who is otherwise blind, metaphorically blind. That's going to be a key question. What does blind mean in each of the three concepts? Does it mean he is actually unaware of information? What if he is aware? We're going to discuss that soon. That is certainly an important question. The middle interpretation, giving bad advice, what the rabbis call Eitza Sheina Hogenes, is the one that's the subject of our talk today. The first one, the most literal one, placing a stumbling block in front of the blind, that is the least discussed example. That is something, actually, it's not even clear that it exists. The traditional rabbinic literature doesn't even entertain the notion that you can violate the prohibition by actually placing a stumbling block. Various later authorities over the last several hundred years have raised the question, do we take the verse at all literally, that it actually incorporates too the prohibition of placing a physical stumbling block? Some take for granted that it does, some take for granted that it doesn't. Orthodox Judaism, we're a pretty traditional religion. Sometimes we get accused even of fundamentalism. Maybe yes, maybe not. Well, we are not our hyper-literalists. Not everything in the Bible is meant to be interpreted absolutely 100% literally. And there are major rabbinic thinkers who say this is an example of something where the literal meaning is not actually the biblical prohibition. It's certainly not nice. It certainly violates love thy neighbor, love thy fellow man as thyself. It's certainly not a nice thing to do, but whether it actually violates the actual prohibition of lifnei iver l'sitein michshol is a matter of some debate. But what we're focused on here today is the middle one, the question of providing eitza sheina hogenes, the provision of bad advice, violates a biblical prohibition. We should also note, and this is going to be a point that becomes relevant throughout our discussion that weaves in and out, many scholars have raised the question, causing somebody to sin, in a very real sense, is included in giving him bad advice. If I tell someone, here's a non-kosher hamburger, it's delicious, I think you should eat it, so I'm causing him to sin. And B, I'm giving him really bad advice. Sin is bad. He'll have to answer to God. And so sin is always bad advice. Some various authorities suggest that the causing somebody to sin has an aspect of being a corollary to the prohibition against bad advice. Nevertheless, there are extensive, as I mentioned earlier, there are extensive technical rules that govern the scope, that offer parameters for the prohibition of causing somebody to sin, and that's really somewhat beyond our discussion. We're focused on the general broad notion of providing bad advice. Now, it's noteworthy that when the Midrash gives the Sifri, when the Midrash gives the example of bad advice, the example provided by the Midrash is not just bad advice, but self-interested bad advice. It talks about a case where you want to buy somebody's cow, you want to buy somebody's property. It's not really in his interest to sell it. Dr. Friedman has an essay on Lifnei Evrei included here where he gives an example in the third paragraph or so. The Midrash says that you should not tell another party, sell your field to buy a donkey when your goal is you want that particular real estate. Now, the general consensus is the prohibition is not contingent on having an ulterior motive, on having a conflict of interest disclosed or otherwise. Nevertheless, the example the Midrash gives is where your bad advice is motivated by a conflict of interest, but it's safe to assume generally that the prohibition against giving bad advice does not depend on that. The mere fact that the advice is bad in and of itself is prohibited. So now the question we have to discuss is, so given that there is a prohibition of bad advice, we don't have a lot of detail in the halakhic tradition for, again, what the scope are, what the parameters are. So how would that apply to a financial advisor? So again, I'm your financial advisor. You come, you want to invest some money. I tell you, I think you should put it into this particular investment vehicle. Now, if it's clearly a bad choice, if there are clearly choices, if it's inappropriate, if it fails even the suitability standard, somebody tells me, I have some money, I want to buy a house in the next 6 months to a year, I want to have a nice place to park the money for 6 months, and you tell them I have these quadruple leveraged emerging market funds, which I think are a great place to store the money for 6 months, and you clearly are giving him terrible advice. That's something which is not a safe and secure investment, which is what he needs. That's obviously bad advice. Similarly, if the guy would tell you, I'm 22, I want to save some money for retirement, I plan to retire when I'm 74, I'd like to put the money someplace for 50 years, and you say I have some 30-day treasuries, they're very secure, it's a great place to park your money, and that's also terrible advice because you need some kind of growth, you want to develop the asset. So clearly an investment which is completely unsuitable, which is bad for whatever reason, because it doesn't meet his goals, because the fees are too high, I would go so far as to say telling him to put money in a fund that charges 1% with when there's another fund that does exactly the same thing and tracks the same index for literally 1/25th of the price, I would argue that is really bad advice too, unless there are, again, mitigating circumstances I don't know about. If you really feel the customer service of one is much better, or their track record, or they're less likely to go out of business, I don't think BlackRock or Vanguard are in any way inferior companies to Vanguard is an inferior company to whatever other one is charging 25 times the price. But again, so an investment can clearly be bad, can clearly fail the suitability standard, and that would clearly be bad advice if you recommend it. What's less clear is if you don't actually recommend it, if the customer comes to you and says, I saw a commercial for this product on TV, I want you to sell it to me, you're a broker of some sort, you actually don't think this is the best investment for him, you think that he's being misled by a slick television pitch or something like that. So what are your obligations to talk him out of it or to simply refuse to sell it to him? You say, this is not suitable for you. I don't think you should buy this. And I, matter of principle, it's unethical for me to sell this to you. Do you actually have to go that far? This is really an interesting question, whether the prohibition against giving bad advice requires you to go, A, do you have to say anything at all? You didn't make any recommendation. He just wants to buy it. Can you sell it to him? Or do you have to advise him it's against his interest? And B, if he refuses to listen to you, do you have to actually go so far as to say, I will not sell it to you? These questions I saw discussed by several contemporary authors. Rabbi Mordechai Willig of YU, heard a lecture from him once where he talked about this. He was speaking to business students, and he discussed exactly this question of a couple, an unsophisticated, what the law and the ethical guidelines call unsophisticated investors, come in, they want to buy a certain product, they're convinced that it's right for them, you don't think it's right for them. Rabbi Willig takes a pretty hard line. He argues that there is a prohibition of Lifnei Iver, and returning to your question, what about the fact that they should know, they do know, the facts are all on the table, they're not being misled by anything, they're just blinded by greed or by, they're blinded by the possibility of great returns. Rabbi Willig goes so far as to argue that they are considered blind for these purposes, that since they're not making a rational judgment, their judgment is being clouded by the visions of outside risks, perhaps by media manipulation. He actually suggests that it might be prohibited entirely to sell it to them. At the very least, he says, you at least have to give them a clear, unambiguous, explicit recommendation that I think this is wrong. I think you're making a mistake. I think this is not suitable for you. If they nevertheless say, we heard your recommendation, we override you, it's our money, we want to do what we will, then everybody Willig says, maybe you can sell it to them.
Is there a distinction if you think they'll go to somebody else to make the purchase?
It's an important point. We'll get to that soon. So, in analyzing this position of Rabbi Willig, there are a couple of points we need to raise. So the first question is, let's say you don't say anything. Rabbi Willig seems to feel that you may be violating Lifnei Iver by selling it to them. So one very interesting question that comes up is, can you violate Lifnei Iver passively by not providing a positive recommendation, by simply failing to say anything? Can you violate Lifnei Iver? This is not something which is clear in the classic sources, in the early sources. Most of the early sources, when they give examples of Lifnei Iver, whether they're the physical Lifnei Iver of stumbling blocks, bad advice, or causing someone to sin, they're usually referring to something active, actively providing somebody with treif non-kosher food, or actually placing the stumbling block, or actively providing advice. If you simply passively allow somebody to stumble without taking steps to prevent him from stumbling, it is far from clear that that violates Lifnei Iver. You can argue actually selling him the item is considered active. It's debatable. You're not giving him bad advice. You're simply, once he wants to buy it, you're selling it to him. We can debate whether that's active or passive, but the general question of whether Lifnei Iver applies passively is a subject of debate among relatively recent scholars. A couple of the writers I saw on the topic cite Chama Leibowitz, the Bible teacher from Israel. She points to a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says that there used to be a practice in ancient times that if there were graves that were not properly marked, they'd either never been marked or the markings had eroded somehow. So there would be people, there was a mitzvah, the Talmud says, to go mark the grave to avoid questions of ritual impurity. Kohanim can't traverse graves. People who are eating truma or kudshim, certain special types of foods with special sanctity, cannot come in contact with graves. So apparently, to prevent these kinds of sins, even inadvertent sins possibly, people used to mark the graves. The Talmud wants to know what the biblical source, what the halachic source for such a practice is. One of the suggestions of the Talmud is, Lifnei Iver lo sitein michshol. Not marking the graves would violate the prohibition against placing a stumbling block. So, as Nechama Leibowitz says, this is the implication of the Talmud here is that even by refraining from doing what you need to do, by allowing others to stumble when you have the possibility of taking steps to prevent it, that itself is a version of Lifnei Iver. I encountered a ruling by Rabbi Chaim Berlin, a leading Lithuanian authority of about a century ago, the one after whom the yeshiva in Brooklyn is named. He was a son of Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of Volozhin, very distinguished Lithuanian scholar of about a century ago. He was asked about a case of very akin to the modern questions we were discussing about having guests who are not, don't keep Shabbos and so on, who would be coming to your house. He was discussing patronizing a physician who is not religious. Now, anything he has to do to treat you and is, you know, very often will override Shabbos, certainly if there's danger. But he talks about, you know, writing his notes or writing things which are just his logs or other things which are not strictly required for the treatment. So if you patronize him, he may wind up, this is a question discussed by contemporary authorities too, he may wind up doing things that halacha does not allow. So one of the points that Rabbi Berlin was debating with his other rabbinic correspondent, another rabbi named Rabbi Moshe Nachum Yerushalimsky, was whether we can view this as non-active causation of sin. You're not doing anything to cause him to do it. I mean, you are knocking on his door and asking him to treat you, but you're not asking him to write, you're not encouraging him to write. You know that it's likely that if you choose to frequent this doctor, he may wind up doing an avera. You aren't providing him with the pen or the paper. You aren't instructing him to do it. So the Rabbi Chaim Berlin's correspondent, Rabbi Yerushalimsky, had argued this is passive Lifnei Iver. Passive Lifnei Iver, you're not actively inciting it. You're simply allowing him to transgress. Is not your responsibility. Rabbi Chaim Berlin himself disagrees. He says the preponderance of halachic thought is that if you could take other action that would prevent it, even passively, you are violating Lifnei Iver, and that was one of their many points of disagreement about whether you should frequent such a physician on Shabbos. So in any event, this is one area of debate, whether whether by not acting, by passively refraining to act, you can violate Lifnaver. Dr. Friedman, I saw, wants to argue that by failing to blow the whistle when people are doing illicit things, you may be violating Lifnaver if you take this view that a failure to act can be Lifnaver. And the truth is, in many of these cases, certainly in the case of failing to blow the whistle on criminal wrongdoing in the corporate world or in the government world, there will often be another issue, which, independent of Lifnaver, there is another issue. There's another set of biblical commandments which, in these types of cases, will intersect the prohibition on not placing stumbling blocks, and that is you have a duty, unlike under American law, you have a duty, essentially, to be a good Samaritan. There is a well-known commandment of Ashas Aveda, returning lost property. Again, unlike typical modern American law, you have no obligation to return lost wallets or to help cats out of trees or whatever it is. If you're a private citizen, you have no duty to help people avoid loss or to return lost property. In halacha, you absolutely do. Halacha says if you can, at least at no cost to yourself, return lost property or prevent someone from suffering a loss in the first place, you are obligated to do so. There are several biblical commandments that apply here. One of them is the simple rule of Hashavas Aveda. The Torah says you must return lost property. Another is Lo Samar al Damreecha. There is a prohibition against standing even passively standing by while someone suffers a loss, certainly loss to life, but the Talmud understands that even loss to property is included, even injury or even loss to personal property is included, real property, personal property is all included. So in general, if you are in a position where you observe that someone is committing crimes, again, not victimless crimes, but if someone is committing crimes which harm others, someone's embezzling money from the company coffers, somebody's otherwise doing something which is harming somebody improperly, you will very often have a duty to the victim because of Hashavas Aveda and because of Lo Samar al Damreecha, whether the victim is a customer of the company, whether the victim is the company itself and its shareholders. Generally, you will have duties to, certainly if there are Jews involved, you will have duties to prevent any loss. So blowing the whistle, you might be required to do so because of Hashavas Aveda. One major limitation on Hashavas Aveda, which likely applies in many or most or all whistleblowing cases, is that one major limitation on the mandatory nature of Hashavas Aveda, you are not required to do so at the cost of any loss to yourself, whether it's financial loss, whether it's be loss of professional standing, certainly if threats of retaliation. If you have a legitimate and reasonable expectation or fear of loss, even loss of income is included in this, you're not obligated to do so at any cost to yourself, unless, the halacha is, unless you are confident of reimbursement. So the typical reimbursement would have been from the victim himself. The halacha is, if I find someone's lost wallet and I have to take a bus ride across town to return it to him, or I have to place an ad to track down the owner, I'm not obligated to do that. However, if I'm reasonably confident that I will be able to recoup those costs from the person whose property I returned, obviously that means the costs are less than the value of the item, and obviously the halacha is I have to have a reasonably confident, I have to be reasonably assured that I will be able to find the owner and get him to pay. But if I'm able to do that, I'm supposed to return the property and then charge him. Today, if there are whistleblower statutes that will give you some of the money that they recover, and that's going to be equal to whatever cost you have, you can argue, I suppose, that if there's really no cost to you, again, there are other costs. There are costs of losing your job, having your career hurt. There are costs of other types of retaliation. And who knows what? So obviously, you have to. It's a judgment call. But the point is, you are not obligated to engage in Hashavas Aveda or Lifnaver, at least in a non when there's no threat to life, if there will be cost to your cost to yourself.
I was just going to raise the issue in terms of if there are other non-economic costs, like just take a tremendous amount of time. Let's say there wouldn't be economic cost of returning the wallet. Take you a lot of time. Is that a fact?
That's a very important question. This is a very deep and perplexing paradox that I've struggled with for many years in Jewish law. There are many types of mitzvahs, particularly those between man and his fellow man, where the halacha explicitly gives you a dispensation for economic loss. It explicitly does not give you a dispensation for time and effort. So, for example, Hashavas Aveda, if it'll take you time to return it, you have to do it. And if you actually lose money, if you have to take an hour off from work, then you can charge the person you're helping whatever lost wages, even opportunity cost, lost wages. So economic damages you can charge. But the fact that if you're going to spend time with your kids during that time, and now you're deprived of that, even though a person might pay a lot of money for that, but you cannot charge for that. So, and everything in between is very unclear. We used to give the example, someone's going to be late for dinner and his wife will be upset at him. So is that not an economic loss, but it's clearly a loss. It's clearly... The, so it's...
Divorce is expensive.
So these things are very unclear, and very unclear how we reckon with these types of non-economic losses. And the paradox is that all of us, you know, most of us are not rigorously consistent, but all of us would have some trade-off. We would have some level of inconvenience, some level of schlepping through the streets and on a hot day with heavy boxes. We'd pay something to avoid it, and yet the halacha says even a dollar, technically, it's always praiseworthy to return anyway if it's a small amount of money, but technically you don't have to lose even a dollar to return lost property, but unless you can recoup it, but you do have to spend considerable amounts of time and effort. Where the logic is and what do you do with a conversion like that, I don't have a good answer. But basically the answer is economic costs, even lost wages are all valid dispensations for these things. Time and effort generally is not, and other types of losses, like personal, personal social discomfort is less clear. So this is one issue, that the financial planner, if he actually makes a recommendation and it's not suitable, he would clearly violate Lifnei Iver. If he does not make the recommendation, does he have an obligation to speak up? So again, if you Lifnei Iver, it's not clear you can violate passively. Not clear again whether choosing to sell it is considered an active, an act, something active or something passive. Hashavas Aveda would again likely not apply because once again, if you stand to make a commission on this, you're not obligated to lose your commission so someone else can get a better deal. So Hashavas Aveda probably would not apply. The fact that he can do better and buy the same product with a cheaper commission somewhere else. Consider every store owner. You sell microwaves, you sell this model for $50. You know that on Amazon, maybe you can get it for $40. It's the same model. So you're allowed to sell it for $50 in many cases. You're not obligated to warn a potential customer, by the way, you should know, I want to act as your fiduciary. It's in your best interest to know that you can buy the same model for cheaper online or even down the block.
I mean, this is a whole other discussion, but there are questions on this concept of overcharging, which is a...
Yes. Yes, so there is the question of onah. Overcharging can be a prohibition. There are extensive halachas about that. I'm simplifying here, but in general, the consensus is that if you're charging within a range of broadly accepted market prices, where there are vendors who are charging roughly what you are, you're not an extreme outlier, you're charging within a reasonable range, generally you will not violate, according to most contemporary authorities, prohibitions of onah. If you're not taking advantage of ignorance, you're not preying on the naive, and you're selling something which is in a reasonably close and in a broad range of, with broadly speaking, reasonable, the price itself is generally permitted. And obviously, it's clear that it's the tacit assumption of all of the halacha that you have no obligation to inform your customer that he can do better somewhere else. There is actually a very interesting question, which is also related to this whole question of bad advice. What should you do as a third party? Your friend, your acquaintance tells you, oh, I'm planning on dropping by Abe's Electronics after work to pick up a microwave. I'm buying this and this model for $40. And you know, again, Amazon, he can do better. Walmart, he can do better. Somewhere else, he can do better. Should you tell him? Should you not tell him? Should you do nothing? Is it up to you? On the one hand, you can argue, I can do a chesed. I can do a mitzvah. I can help a Jew save some money. On the other hand, the store owner is a person too. He's also trying to make a living. He might be Jewish too. Maybe I should take his interest into account. He is allowed to make an honest living. So why should I take sides here? So this is a surprisingly unclear question in the halacha. Again, it's not usually analyzed in terms of Lifnei Iver because by doing nothing, I'm not providing bad advice. Again, we saw there are some who say that even passively allowing somebody to make a bad decision is Lifnei Iver. That's a kind of speculative argument, but halakhic authorities do try to untangle what is the right thing to do in such a case, and there is no real consensus on what the correct thing to do is. The Chafetz Chaim, who literally wrote the book on Lashon Hara and slander, he actually discusses a version of this case. He talks about a case where you know that a customer is about to overpay for an item, should you tell him. So his ruling is that if he's overpaying, and this takes us to your point, if the storekeeper is violating the laws of Onah, is charging a prohibited markup, it's too much, it's beyond the reasonable price, and he violates the biblical prohibition of Onah. Again, the exact details of that are beyond the scope of our talk. But if the store owner is, let's call it cheating and unfairly, illegitimately gouging the customer, then he says it's an open and shut case. You have to speak up. You have to speak up to save the victim from being cheated. And you should certainly stop the other person from doing that. And then there's no question the right thing to do is to speak up and warn the customer. If, however, in my example, where the storekeeper is charging a markup which is legitimate, The Chafetz Chaim seems to assume that you should not say anything. What he's not sure about is a case where there is some debate in the poskim whether his markup is legitimate. He really shouldn't be doing it because he should be stringent, but it's not clear that he's doing something wrong. In that case, in that kind of balanced middle ground, he's not exactly sure what you should do. But the Chafetz Chaim does seem to assume that as long as the storekeeper's markup is acceptable, is unquestionably halakhically acceptable, you should not step in to help the customer at the expense of the seller. Some suggest that the principle is shev al taseh, do nothing. You know, why mix in? You have two people who are working at a deal on whatever terms they want. Let them make their own decisions. Let them do their own research. Why should you step in, put your finger on the scale in favor of one party as opposed to another? There is a passage in the Talmud which does seem to say this. The Talmud talks about a case where you are somebody's business agent. You are somebody's foreman. He tells you, please go hire me workers. I am willing to pay $10 an hour. The foreman goes ahead. He knows something about the market himself. He tells the laborers, will you do this job for $8 an hour? Doesn't tell them he has an order that his principal is offering 10. They say, okay, $8 an hour, you know, we'll accept it. We'll take it. And then they find out that that he was actually commissioned to offer 10. The halacha is he has done something wrong. The biblical verse that brings is a pasuk called Al Timna Tov Mi Ba'alav, do not withhold good from him to whom it would otherwise have been coming. Since the employer was willing to pay 10, the workers could have had 10, nobody would have cared, and you cut them down to 8, you are doing something wrong. So some interpret this as a general rule that if two people are, if you don't intervene, if barring your intervention, they will reach some agreement, and you put your finger on the scale to cause them to end up at some other price point, you're doing something wrong. Others add various limitations to the Talmudic rule. The Talmud doesn't really develop this in a rigorous way. Others limit the Talmud to very specific cases. For example, one opinion is that workers, laborers, typically in the time of the Talmud and commonly today too, are assumed to be the poorer party to the transaction. They're assumed to be the less advantaged and more in need of the money. So they're poor, give them a break, they need the money. The guy's willing to pay 10, they need the money, let him pay 10. But if it's two equal parties, who the customer versus the storekeeper, if anything, you can argue the storekeeper is often, I mean, some storekeepers are struggling too, so there are no rules here. Some employees are making a lot more money than their employers. Some doctors are making a lot more money than their patients, obviously. So you can't say a hard and fast rule that every employer is richer than every employee or every storekeeper is richer than every customer, obviously. But some say the Gemara's rule is limited to a case where one party is clearly economically disadvantaged relative to the other party.
Does it make a difference whether the foreman pockets the extra $2 or whether the manager...
Yeah, we're not talking about a case where the foreman is taking anything for himself. We're talking about where he's acting solely on behalf of his employer, negotiating a contract which is more favorable to his employer. Now, again, there's no question the employer can say, I authorize you to find me the best deal you can. In many cases, that's what he'll do, and that's fine. Then he certainly has to act as the fiduciary of his employer and act in his best interest. We're talking about a case where the employer set the price and he just sets a different price and calls up his boss and says, by the way, boss, I saved you a lot of money today. I got you a better contract. That's what the Talmud says he shouldn't do. And that is, again, considerable debate among later authorities as to how to apply that to modern types of transactions. Now, the question was brought up before. How does Lifnei Iver, going back to the prohibition of Lifnei Iver, how does Lifnei Iver apply to cases where the victim, so to speak, the victim has the information? He's not actually blind. So when it comes to prohibitions, the Lifnei Iver and causing somebody to sin, there is a pretty strong consensus that even if he is going to sin deliberately, he knows the food is non-kosher, nevertheless, you are still violating a prohibition of Lifnei Iver. The Rambam, Maimonides, pretty clearly says this in several places. And he uses fairly poetic language to explain why. When he explains Lifnei Iver, he says, you should not provide somebody with the means, the opportunity to sin. He says, because such a person, this would be called Lifnei Iver, he says, putting a stumbling block before the blind man, because his passions and his evil inclination are clouding his judgment and rendering him blind in this matter. So the Maimonides' language pretty clearly indicates that he's not actually ignorant of the facts or of the law. He knows the halacha and he knows the facts, but his passions are blinding him. His passions are causing him to sin anyway. That's considered he's blind in this matter. So the question is, that's, I think, more or less the consensus view when it comes to the version of Lifnei Iver of causing him to sin. The question is, what about the Lifnei Iver of bad advice? So again, if someone knows exactly what he's doing, is making a decision, his decision happens to be different from yours, but that's certainly not Lefnaiver. He knows exactly what he wants. He's entitled to have his own opinions, and that I would say is certainly not Lefnaiver. The question is, in this kind of in-between case, where he's unsophisticated, he was manipulated by slick advertising, the people are always debating how well advertising works. I think there are studies that say most people believe that they are relatively immune to the blandishments of advertising, yet Madison Avenue spends a great deal of money on advertising, and they're not stupid either, so somebody must believe that somebody is susceptible to advertising. So the question is, if we assume that advertising is capable of clouding people's judgment, greed, the picture of a big payout, if we assume that these things can cloud people's judgment, it becomes a point where they even talk about addiction. People talk about gambling addiction. You can be addicted to things. That's whether it's chemical, whether it's habit forming, or whatever it is. Certainly, we can accept that there's a whole spectrum of perspectives between making a good decision, which might not be correct, and between being completely clouded by extraneous motivations. But Rabbi Willig, as I mentioned earlier, makes this point that if you're clouded by greed, he calls that shochad, bribery, corruption. He says someone whose judgment is clouded by greed, essentially clouded by whatever is causing him to think this is a good idea, he treats that person to some extent as an evil. Yet it is not clear. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, another one of the leading Lithuanian scholars from early to mid last century, he says there actually is a contrast between the Lefnaiver of bad advice and the Lefnaiver of causing somebody to sin. He says when it comes to sin, we have Maimonides' language, we have the general rule that someone who sins is, nevertheless, it's a sin, and the prohibition applies anyway. He's called an Iver for these purposes, and it is prohibited. When it comes to bad advice, he says, or when it comes to the physically placing a stumbling block in the path of the physically blind, then it's a simple question, yes or no. Is he blind? Is he ignorant of the truth or not? If he's not, he's not. We don't start invoking these notions of he's overwhelmed by passion and by greed, and that's clouding his judgment. To the extent, Rabbi Grudzinski discusses an interesting point raised by a number of the later scholars. I touched on this earlier. They want to know whether every time I cause you to sin, am I also giving you bad advice? Do I also violate because besides the fact that sin, God doesn't like it, it's certainly bad for you to sin. God doesn't want you to sin, and there are reasons he doesn't want you to sin, so clearly sin is bad for you. Do I also violate bad advice? So Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grudzinski says there would be a difference whether the sin here is deliberate, what we call mazid, or shogeg aronis, inadvertent, or beyond my control. If the sin is deliberate, he says, then you would still violate the lefneiver of avera because it is an avera, like the Rambam says, because it's still a sin. It's deliberate, but you're still called an ever because you're not thinking clearly if you're sinning. Yet, when it comes to bad advice, he says, the fact that sin is bad advice, that would not apply. The bad advice interpretation of lefneiver would not apply. You're not an ever. You know what you're doing, he says, despite the fact that your judgment is clouded by passion. When it comes to bad advice, he says, he seems to fail. We simply look at, objectively, do you have the information that you need to make a proper decision? You do. Yes. Then there is no further prohibition of bad advice, and all there is the lefneiver of sin. When it comes to inadvertent transgression, he doesn't know that the food is non-kosher, or he doesn't have some of the facts, whether it's he doesn't know some of the law, he doesn't know some of the facts. Then, Rabbi Grudzinski says, both lefnevers would apply. The prohibition of causing him to sin applies, and the prohibition of giving him bad advice applies. So again, when it comes to these types of cases of investment advice and so on, if we want to know whether selling him the product constitutes bad advice, so on the one hand, there's nothing misleading about it. The nutrition information on the food, let's say, third essay I included here is by another contemporary rabbi, or by Yair Hoffman. He talks about a case. He says he was actually asked this question by an ice cream store, which wants to know if it can sell decadent and unhealthy ice creams, particularly to even to those for whom such confections might not be healthy, someone who is sick enough that it's really going to be bad for him. So he discusses at length all these questions of bad advice and so on. He raises the question, you're not hiding anything. The nutrition information is out there and it's published. And he actually discusses whether this would be Lefnaiver. So again, according to Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, it would presumably not be, because there's no sin here. Assuming there's no sin for a moment, it's simply a question of it being bad advice, it being not a good idea for him to do this, and as long as all the information is out there, then Rabbi Grudzinski and others argue there is no prohibition against providing bad advice because you're not misleading him. All the information is there. Furthermore, there are the other questions we raised. Are you actually providing advice at all? You're not providing advice. You're simply making the product available. If he wants to buy it, his decision. You're not, even if you advertise it, you're not recommending it for him. You're certainly not recommending it for the person who's sick. Certainly, you know, the alcohol companies, the tobacco companies always, they tell you, use our product responsibly. Whether that means anything or not, I can't tell you. It's hard to know, but whether they think they're really accomplishing anything or not, I don't know. But on the other hand, it's not, you know, hard to hear that they aren't actually recommending that you buy it if it's not good for you. They're making it available. So again, Rabbi Willig argues that because the person is shochad, is blinded by the deliciousness of it and its attractive appearance, maybe that is considered somehow shochad. Rabbi Hoffman says something very interesting. He actually goes so far as to say that he thinks that selling somebody food that is bad for him actually violates the third version of Lifnei Iver, the prohibition against placing a physical stumbling block in the path of the blind. That seems like a bit of a stretch to me. All the discussions I saw of the physical stumbling block interpretation seem to interpret it hyper-literally as an actual stumbling block in the place of someone who's actually blind, not putting any kind of physical thing that can cause harm to somebody else in any manner, shape, or form. But to me, the primary question would be one of providing bad advice. And the questions are, A, you're not really providing advice at all. You are agreeing to sell it. The question is, does an agreement to sell constitute advice? Is that considered active or passive? And the third question is this one, whether the fact that he has all the information that he needs and he's simply, you know, blinded by greed or lust or whatever it is, does that make him an iver, a blind person, for the purpose of our prohibition? The purpose of our prohibition or not. Yes?
So if you aren't allowed to discriminate if you sell to, does that mean you couldn't sell ice cream at all?
An interesting question. If you aren't allowed to discriminate, so I'm not a lawyer. I certainly can't tell you the law. I don't know if the law would say you can't discriminate even on the basis of solid, it being, I guess, the America, you're probably damned if you do, damned if you know. If you don't sell it to him, he can sue you for discrimination. You do sell it to him, he can probably sue you for causing, you know, like the causing harm, selling a product which is not suitable, or for I don't actually know the legal framework.
No, I mean there are regulations, perhaps laws, that if you're a bartender or a restaurant, or in fact even a hostess on a plane, you're not supposed to sell, they don't say, serve liquor to somebody who's clearly inebriated.
Right.
So that, I mean, as far as the liquor is concerned, it's case. Now, whether you can refuse to serve, chocolate pudding to somebody who's clearly obese.
So that's a particularly sensational example. But in principle, the question you're asking, if it was clear, make a bunch of stipulations. If we accept as clear the halacha says you could not sell to someone for whom it would be harmful, and the law did not accept that distinction, and the law would therefore make it illegal for you, it requires you to either sell to everyone or not, then yes, then very likely you'd be prohibited from selling at all. You can't violate Lifnei Iver just because I have no other legal way out. If the only solution is not to sell, then you probably would have to avoid selling that product. Yes?
There are a number of aspects of this which I find very disturbing. One of which is the distinction between, as you pointed out, the vendor versus the advisor, because that seems like something of a specious distinction. If you go into a store and someone says, you should buy these oranges, they're really tasty, you're not going to find better anywhere. Is that person a vendor or an advisor? That seems to be not a clear line. Another thing that bothers me is that it's very rare that there's a transaction as the one you described, where clearly this guy is cheating him, or this is clearly a better choice than that one. They're very rare in economics choices where, because everyone has individual evaluation, where something is clearly better for someone than someone.
Okay, so to address those points, at least partially.
The one that really bothers me, which I'd rather you address it, is the example that you mentioned and the Chama Leibovitz brought up from the Gemara about the idea of this kind of passive responsibility that at some point a hypothetical Kohen or person who might exist or might not exist might pass by here or not. That seems to place an awful lot of responsibility on us.
Okay, so let me try to address at least briefly all three. First point about the distinction between a vendor and an advisor. The distinction, I agree, is not a rigorous one, but I think it's largely an intuitive one. That I think the question is, where is the perception of that person's loyalty and interests, what are his interests perceived as? When you go into a store, I think it's clearly understood that his interests and yours are divergent. You know, he's not a public servant. We're not talking about a government-run store. We're talking about a private enterprise. I think it's basically understood that his interests are one set of interests, yours are another. And I think it's widely understood that he's out, he's not going to cheat you. Again, if he says things that are not true, there's no question that's prohibited. That's prohibited for a whole variety of reasons of illegitimate commercial practices. But assuming what he's telling you is true, he's telling you these oranges are delicious. Let's say they are delicious, but let's say his competitor sells the same delicious oranges for 10% less or something, or that there are other oranges that are even more delicious, but he makes less of a markup on them. Assuming what he's telling you is true, I think people understand that the store owner is not in the business, that his loyalty is primarily to himself. The broker dealer is more complicated because the person paying his salary and his commissions are not coming from you directly. They're coming from the investments he sells or the firms that pay him sometimes. On the other hand, you see him often as being working for you. It's more complicated. So at the end of the day, I agree. It's not always easy, especially in the financial industry, to always draw a bright line distinction. But to a large extent, I think intuitively, and the halakha also, I think, would say it revolves to a large extent on where the perception of loyalty on the part of the person is, whether the person thinks he's being told things in his best interest or understands that the guy's his own interests at stake. Second point you raised was
the situation is rare.
Yeah, how clicker. Yeah, so this is true in law and halakha in general. The point is, it's easier to discuss the rules and use kind of concrete or even extreme cases. That's why I picked the example that I began with about two funds that have exactly the same legal definition. The companies that stand behind them are exactly the same, and one of them charges 25 times more than the other one. So that was kind of an easy example. Hard cases make bad law, the expression goes. So I agree, to apply these in the real world is not going to be easy, and I'm not trying to pass an halacha l'maaseh here and give necessarily actionable guidance that will cover most real world cases. But I think it's important to try to understand the principles as best as we can through the use of some relatively clear-cut cases. And you're right, in the real world, most cases are going to be somewhat murky and somewhat gray, and we have to do the best we can to apply the principles to these types of cases. Regarding the third point about where's the limit and how far does this go, you know, to what extent do you have to go around for Tikkun Olam about fixing all problems that exist, you know, cleaning up every spill and every toxic substance and fix every pothole in a road because somebody might fall into it and break his leg at some point. I agree. Practically, I don't know what the answer would be. Aside from, you know, Chamalevich's case, which was meant more as exegesis and a general value statement, aspirational, the Poskim will actually discuss passive lifnei iver. To be fair, right, I should have made this point more clearly. They were really discussing cases where you're in some way instigating it, but you're not actually inciting it. I may not be using the best word, but like the example of Rebecca in Berlin, where you're going to the doctor, you're not telling him to write things down, you don't want him to write things down, it's not part of your treatment plan, but you know that by taking this action, you know that it may result in him doing that. Or by inviting that some of these cases, you're not recommending it, you're not encouraging it, you're not providing him the tray food and saying, here, this is for you to eat, but you know that by doing what you do, it may result this kind of approximate connection. Right, the whistleblowing example again, like Dr. Friedman's example, that by not blowing the whistle you are passively violent. That I agree with you, that I think is something of a stretch to say that any action I don't take to make the world a better place then rebounds on my head, that I'm responsible for the world not being better than it is. I agree with you that from a rigorous halakhic perspective, that is something of a stretch. So again, Hashavas Avedan, Lasam al Damriacha do apply, and if you can actually help, again, those are concrete cases. I know there is a whistleblowing case, there's no real connection to you. On the other hand, I have a concrete case where someone's suffering, and someone is going to suffer, is already suffering, and I can alleviate it, and I have to do so. The case that we don't even know it'll exist, someone somewhere might have a loss down the road, I agree with you, that is very speculative, and it would be difficult to make the case that a rigorous prohibition of lifnei iver would apply in such a case.